The excuse for a final war came when Antony made his plans public, in a lavish ceremony in the gymnasium at Alexandria. Here a silver dais was set up, with two golden thrones upon it, one for himself and one for Cleopatra, and other seats for Cleopatra's children. Then he declared his lover, who was dressed as Isis, queen of Egypt, Cyprus, Libya, and Celesyria, to share that throne with Caesarion, her son by Caesar. He then proclaimed his own son by Cleopatra, King of Kings, and allotted to him further territories, including the vast expanses of Armenia, Parthia, Media, Syria, and Phoenicia. In short, he had claimed half the known world. The resolution of the Roman Senate against him and his Egyptian queen, who is now, thanks to Octavian's brilliant propaganda, known in Rome as the Ruinous Monster, made war inevitable. The Alexandrian dream had seduced Rome's greatest general, and now he would have to fight for it. Octavian finally met these would-be Eastern emperors, not on land, but off the coast of Actium in Greece. The sea battle was brief and bloody, and within a few short hours Antony and Cleopatra were fleeing for the distant safety of Alexandria's walls. Her ships entered the great harbour as tradition dictated, to the strains of victory songs and garlanded with flowers, but not even she could hide this defeat. She had come home for the last time to the city that had made her, but not in triumph as she had hoped, and she would never leave its walls again. There was to be no sanctuary. Many of the Roman generals who had supported Antony now began to defect, some no doubt just gauging the way the political wind was blowing, others now overtly opposed to this un-Roman dalliance with a woman they considered no more than an unreliable Eastern princess. In their eyes, Cleopatra had brought Rome nothing but trouble, trouble for Pompey, trouble for Julius Caesar, trouble for Mark Antony, and now trouble for them. In the spring of 30 BC, Octavian's armies began to march on Alexandria. Antony managed one final victory in the outskirts of the city by the Hippodrome, but when he returned to the battlefield the following day, his fleet and cavalry went over to the enemy. On August the 1st, when Octavian walked into Alexandria, the Ptolemaic kingdom came to an end. With Octavian on his way to the palace, Cleopatra retired to her mausoleum, sending a note to Antony to say she was already dead. Hearing this, he fell on his sword in despair. The blow was not immediately fatal, however, and he was still writhing in agony when word came that Cleopatra was not dead. In his last moments he asked to be carried into her presence so he might die in her arms. Tied to a cord and hauled up through a high window, for Cleopatra would not open the door for fear of betrayal, he finally gained admittance to the tomb, and that last wish was granted. Cleopatra did not immediately follow him to the grave. She was flushed out of her mausoleum after Octavian managed to get one of his guards in through the same window as the dying Antony. She immediately tried to stab herself, but Octavian's orders were that she be taken alive, and she was overpowered and brought to him only wounded. Perhaps Cleopatra at least thanked him for being granted the chance to bury Antony with royal honours. But she can have held out little hope that more kindness awaited her than being paraded through the streets of Rome in Octavian's triumph to the jeers and scorn of a crowd he had taught to hate her. Seeing death as the only noble way out, she then tried to starve herself, but was persuaded against this after threats were made against her children. Finally, after a meeting with Octavian on August the 10th, she persuaded him that she now wished to live, and he dropped his guard. She had bent one last great Roman to her will. 2 days later she was dead. Plutarch describes her last moments. After her bath, she reclined at table and was making a sumptuous meal, and there came a man from the country carrying a basket. And when the guards asked him what he was bringing there, he opened the basket, took away the leaves, and showed them that the dish inside was full of figs. The guards were amazed at the great size and beauty of the figs, whereupon the man smiled and asked them to take some, so they felt no mistrust and bade him take them in. After her meal, however, Cleopatra took a tablet which was already written upon and sealed and sent it to Caesar, and then, sending away all the rest of the company except her two faithful women, she closed the doors. Plutarch, Life of Antony, in Parallel Lives. As soon as Octavian opened the tablet he must have known that it was too late, for in it she begged the Roman to bury her alongside her beloved Antony. He quickly dispatched messengers to her, but they arrived to find her lying dead upon a couch, her body carefully arrayed in state by her two female servants, Iras and Charmian. Iras was herself in the last moments of life as they burst in, while Charmian, also in the throes of death, was trying to arrange a diadem on her mistress's head. One of the messengers turned on her. "A fine deed this, Charmian."
"It is indeed most fine," she said, "and befitting the descendant of so many kings."
Not a word more did she speak, but fell there by the side of the couch. No one can be sure if Cleopatra died from the bite of an Egyptian asp in that basket of figs, as was reported at the time, or from some other poison which, like many rulers of her day, she must have carried about with her. But the story of the asp provides an appropriate death for a queen of Egypt, and the only Ptolemy ever to have learned Egyptian. She had been, perhaps, the most Egyptian ruler of all her dynasty, using her inquisitive Greek mind to look deep into the past of her adoptive home for clues to a future free from Roman domination. She had even beguiled a Roman general into joining her on that journey, an Osiris to play alongside her tragic Isis. But the great days of Egypt she looked wistfully back to had been little more than a memory when Alexandria was founded, and the Egyptian temples she built along the Nile were more an homage to the stories of long-dead pharaohs she had read of in the library than the signs of a resurgent Egypt. Now, at 39 years old, she was dead, and finally resting next to her beloved Antony. As for her children, Caesarion, in many ways the only true heir of Egypt and Rome, was hunted down by Octavian's men and killed. He was about 14 years old. Her children with Antony did survive, although they were forced to walk alongside her picture in which she was portrayed with the asp still clinging to her arm in Octavian's triumph in Rome. Only Cleopatra Selene appears again in the history books after that, married to King Juba II of Mauritania, where she transformed his minor capital of Caesarea into a little Alexandria, complete with sculptures of her illustrious ancestors and even its own small library. Back in the real Alexandria, that library and the city that held it were now Roman possessions. The Ptolemaic dream was dead, but Alexandria's story was still far from over.
Chapter 12. The Clockwork City.
"Your worship is your furnaces, which, like old idols, lost obscenes, have molten bowels. Your vision is machines for making more machines."
Gordon Bottomley, To Iron Founders and Others. The Alexandria that awoke the day after Cleopatra's death was changed but not destroyed. Having been defeated in war, the city might have expected to be erased entirely from the face of the ancient world, as Carthage was in 146 BC, as an example to others who might dare to defy Rome. But this was not to be Alexandria's fate. Octavian limited his revenge to stripping the city of its governing body, or Senate, and founding his own city of Nicopolis, named after a city in Epirus opposite the site of the Battle of Actium, in what was then the suburb of Ar-Rahma. Further humiliation would be unnecessary and, far more important, entirely counterproductive. Egypt was potentially too wealthy, Alexandria was too much of a prize, and what was more, Rome itself was also changing. The Roman province of Egypt, as it now was, had been conquered by a republic, but the general at its head had no intention of maintaining the political traditions of Cicero. He was the first of a new breed of Roman ruler, one who professed republicanism in the name of Octavian, but practiced power as the first emperor, Augustus. Egypt had been where his stepfather, Julius Caesar, and his erstwhile friend, Mark Antony, had looked for the money to conquer the world, and it would be where he would consolidate his rule, taking the Ptolemy's inheritance as his personal fiefdom. Alexandria fascinated the new emperors of Rome in two ways. Economically, it was the port through which 20 million bushels of wheat were annually exported from the Nile Valley, enough to feed the unemployed and restive city mob back in Rome. More important, it was the centre of the intellectual world, an Egyptian city founded on Greek thinking and now ruled by Rome. In its library lay the practical works by men such as Archimedes that had helped Rome build an empire, as well as many others, perhaps yet unread and untapped. And whereas the Republic may have had less time for the higher arts, emperors like pharaohs could be seduced by their association with the great literary names from history and legend whose works filled the colonnades of the library. That was indeed a prize. Alexandria was the most extraordinary city on earth, as Julius Caesar and Mark Antony had learned, and as Augustus was now finding out. Around the roads and gates laid out so long ago by Dinocrates, extraordinary buildings now stood. From just south of the Canopic Way, the Paneum gave a stunning view across the city. This was itself an astonishing structure, a man-made hill in the shape of a fir cone, around which a path spiraled up to a temple dedicated to Pan on the summit. From here the city lay spread out before a visitor. Across the wide granite-paved street lay the Soma, the tomb of Alexander, where the embalmed conqueror of the world still lay in a crystal coffin, though not the original gold casket, which had been melted down, surrounded by the tombs of the Ptolemies. Through the hazy sides of the sarcophagus one might just have made out the scar where the great man's nose had been recently reattached after Augustus had accidentally broken it off when he demanded to touch this sacred relic. Away to the west, beyond the porticos of the gymnasium, stood the great temple of the Serapeum, with its own library and stadium, where annual games celebrated the power of Ptolemy's invented god. Off in the distance to the north lay some of the city's most famous buildings, laid out in stately fashion around the harbour. Most impressive of all, after the palaces themselves, were the enormous grounds and buildings of the Sebastium, or Caesarium, begun by Cleopatra in honour of Mark Antony, but finished by Augustus as a celebration of his victory. Here stood Cleopatra's Needles, the three ancient obelisks Augustus had brought there from Heliopolis, which now stand one on London's embankment, one in New York's Central Park, and one in Paris's Place de la Concorde. Their setting in the Sebastium is described by Philo, a Jewish scholar living in the city in the 1st century AD, as huge and conspicuous, fitted on a scale not found elsewhere with dedicated offerings, around it a girdle of pictures and statues in silver and gold forming a precinct of vast breadth, embellished with porticos, libraries, chambers, groves, gateways, and wide-open courts, and everything which lavish expenditure could produce to beautify it. Philo of Alexandria, the embassy to Gaius. Beyond stood a more sober and sadder sight. By the Temple of Poseidon, where arriving sailors gave thanks for their safe passage across the sea, Mark Antony had built a small promontory out into the harbour. At the end of this stood the Timonium. This temple, built after Antony's defeat at Actium, was named after the misanthropic Timon of Athens, who had been an Athenian lord wronged and mistreated by his friends, who henceforth hated and mistrusted all mankind. He had withdrawn from Athens and lived alone in the wilderness, and Antony, abandoned by his Roman friends, had wished to imitate him. The depths of such despair might be gauged from the epitaph on Timon's tomb, which Callimachus, quoted in Plutarch, says read, "Timon, hater of men, dwells here, so pass along. Heap many curses on me, if thou wilt, only pass along." Plutarch, Life of Antony. Older and happier buildings also crowded around the harbour, and foremost among these was the museum in whose portico Eratosthenes had placed his astrolabe. This remained a lively and extensive institution, with its dining halls, colonnades, and gardens, in part of which roamed the exotic animals of the scholar's private zoo. In the 1st century AD, there would be a sea change here, inspired not by the pure philosophy of Greek thought, but by practical problems of engineering, which would make this the only modern city in the ancient world. The fascination with engineering that so failed to impress Archimedes now began to absorb the scholars of the museum. Rome was a physical empire, not an empire of the mind, and it wanted scholars to find practical solutions to their most pressing problems, conquering and ruling the world. The result would be advances in architecture and engineering that would remain unparalleled until the Renaissance. The first use of concrete, concrete that set underwater, aqueducts, metropolitan sewage systems, high-rise buildings, and, in Alexandria, very nearly a revolution. Among the new breed of inventors who now walked the corridors and gardens of the museum and library
one stood out, Hero, and the revolution he nearly started 1800 years too early was an industrial one. Hero was at one level exactly the type of scholar who had worked at the museum and library for centuries. He was a great geometer. His work, Metrica, which was lost until 1896, dealt with theoretical problems of geometry, finding the areas and volumes of two- and three-dimensional geometric shapes, and reiterating an ancient Babylonian method for estimating square roots, which is still used in computing today. But at another level, Hero was something new. His purpose in studying at the museum and library was practical. Hero professed none of Archimedes' distaste for engineering, but set out to collect the greatest examples from antiquity and add his own to them. For him, theory was just a preliminary to practice. Pappus, an Alexandrian mathematician working around AD 320, considered Hero a mechanician. His school, he tells us, divided mechanics into theory and practice. The theory included the study of geometry, arithmetic, astronomy, and physics, while the practice included metalwork, architecture, carpentry, painting, and any other manual skill. It seems Hero had these skills in perfect balance, and in Pappus's view, that put him among another group, the wonder workers. The ancients also describe as mechanicians the wonder workers, of whom some work by means of pneumatics, as Hero in his Pneumatica, some by using strings and ropes, thinking to imitate the movements of living things, as Hero in his Automata and Balancings, or by using water to tell the time, as Hero in his Hydria, which appears to have affinities with the science of sundials. Pappus, La Collection Mathématique. In fact, in Alexandria in the 1st century AD, Hero was the greatest of the wonder workers. He was a designer and builder of automatons, automatically operated machines, with which he delighted and bemused the people of the city. The machines he built used gravity, pressure, heat, and water to power devices that appeared to operate without human intervention. They would have surprised and bewildered an 18th century European as much as they did Romans and Alexandrians. In his great book, The Pneumatica, he explained the purpose of his life work. By the union of air, earth, fire, and water, and the concurrence of three or four elementary principles, various combinations are effected, some of which supply the most pressing wants of human life, while others produce amazement and alarm. Hero of Alexandria, Pneumatica. Simple machines had been a part of Alexandrian life for centuries before, usually seen in the clanking automatons of the great Ptolemaic parades of the early kings. The museum had been collecting peculiar machines, tricks, and unusual natural objects since its very inception. Ever since Alexander ordered his people to send any strange novelty to Aristotle that he might use it in his teaching, the collection of books had gone hand in hand with the collection of things in the museum. But before now, these were perhaps considered little more than novelties, or at best, talking teaching aids. But in Roman Alexandria, the construction of such novelties now blossomed and expanded. For a moment it looked as though Aristotle's own dream of a mechanized world was about to come true. For if every tool were able to complete its own task when ordered, or even anticipate the need, just as the statues of Daedalus supposedly did, or the tripods of Hephaestus, which Homer says entered of their own accord the assembly of the gods, or shuttles could pass through the loom by themselves, or plectra play the harp, master craftsmen would have no need of assistance, and masters no need of slaves. Aristotle, Politics. If there was a man to take Aristotle at his word, it was Hero. As with so many of the great Alexandrians, we know very little about his private life, but thankfully some of his works survive, either as original texts or as comments and discussions in the works of later engineers and mathematicians. In these books he describes the machines he built and the practical skills he learned in the process, and we also gain a sense of his delight at producing devices which filled their audience with wonder. The machines that Hero built were the wonders of their age. Indeed, they would have been the wonder of many ages since, and their deployment about the city made it appear to visitors to be literally a place of miracles. Some were for the home, simply there as entertainments for dinner parties. Others whirred and clanked away in theatres, producing amazing special effects. But the most likely place to find one of Hero's machines was where magic and miracles were only to be expected, in the temples. Religion in Egypt was a booming business in the early Roman Empire. The Roman view of religion was surprisingly relaxed. Provided that the imperial cult was acknowledged, more a matter of allegiance than belief, most Roman citizens and subjects were free to worship whatever deity they wished. This liberal approach made cities like Alexandria the home to hundreds of cults, from the traditional Roman and Greek pantheons and the worship of the Ptolemaic Serapis, to the uniquely Egyptian mystery cults of Isis and Osiris, to the Mithraism so beloved by the army officer corps, and even the ecstatic Eastern castration cult of Cybele. Within the city, the temples of Isis and Osiris vied with those of the deified Ptolemies, Zeus and Jupiter for the devotion and the money of adherents. Attracting enough worshippers to any one, when there were literally hundreds to choose from, required a miracle. And that's exactly what Hero could provide. Hero could build devices which appeared to perform tasks either without human assistance or through divine intervention. It was the stage magic of its day, utilizing hidden machinery to make an audience stop in the street and look in awe at the show being put on by whichever god was worshipped in the temple where Hero had installed his device. The illusion might begin even before worshippers entered the building, in the form of a machine he describes in Pneumatica. Temple doors opened by fire on an altar. The construction of a small temple such that, on lighting a fire, the doors shall open spontaneously and shut again when the fire is extinguished. Let the proposed temple stand on a pedestal, A, B, C, D. Hero of Alexandria, Pneumatica. As the priest and congregation approached, they would be faced with the huge, closed doors of the temple. Stepping forward, a priest would light a fire on an altar and, as though the god were pleased with the offering, the doors would swing open of their own accord, accompanied by a fanfare of trumpets. Behind the scenes, where only Hero and the priests ever went, a complex series of air and water-filled tubes connected the altar to large bucket counterweights attached to the temple doors by pulleys. As the fire heated the air, it expanded, forcing water in another tube into the buckets, which would then open the doors when there was enough water to weigh them down and set the pulley train in motion. When the fire was extinguished, the air in the pipes cooled and sucked the water back out of the buckets. As the weight in the buckets lessened, so the doors slowly closed under their own weight. It was all just advanced hydraulics, a subject first studied by another Alexandrian, Ctesibius, whose works Hero must have pored over in the library. But the mechanical wonders had only begun. Inside temples, it was very important for worshippers to purify themselves with holy water before any ritual. Selling this could, of course, be a useful additional income stream for a temple struggling against the competition, but collecting the money and dispensing the water was a time-consuming and frankly boring job, taking one of the priests away from his other duties. To ease this problem, Hero invented a sacrificial vessel which flows only when money is introduced. If into certain sacrificial vessels a coin of 4 drams be thrown, water shall flow out and surround them. Let A, B, C, D be a sacrificial vessel or treasure chest, having an opening in its mouth. Hero of Alexandria, Pneumatica. Hero had invented the slot machine. On putting a silver 4-drachma coin in the slot, a measured amount of holy water was dispensed, another little miracle for devotees. With ablutions complete, the acolyte could then proceed into the main sanctuary, where Hero could really allow his imagination to run riot with a series of miracle machines. On an apple being lifted, Hercules shoots a dragon which then hisses. The world represented in the center of the universe. A fountain which trickles by the action of the sun's rays. A trumpet in the hands of an automaton sounded by compressed air. Hero of Alexandria, Pneumatica. In one temple, a steam boiler was used to create a jet of invisible steam on which a ball floated, apparently defying gravity. Hero also talks of a machine which allowed a group of mechanical songbirds to sing in a tree until a mechanical owl turned around to stare at them, at which point they fell silent in terror. And to complete the effect, in the temple gloom behind the miraculous machines, Hero's moving statues blinked and waved,
like exotic extras in a Ray Harryhausen movie. But these devices could also have a more practical use, and raise more money for the temple. Here was a chance for the great engineer to make the gods speak directly to their followers, and like any good showman, he gave them what they wanted. Fortune-telling was a central part of many ancient classical religions, knowledge of the future, or at least a belief in having knowledge of the future, providing some bulwark against the fragility of life. Whole cities and states officially consulted the great oracles, such as the Pythia at Delphi. The fabulously wealthy King Croesus of Lydia had many centuries before, according to Herodotus, asked the Pythia whether he should attack Persia. He had received a typically ambiguous response. "If you do, you will destroy a great empire." Heartened by this, he immediately attacked, only to discover that the empire the Pythia was referring to was his own. Even Alexander had sought the oracle at Siwa to discover if his campaigns would be successful. This may seem like a piece of stage magic today, but the word of the Siwa oracle not only helped Alexander to resolve his course of action, but likely paved the way for his conquests. In the same way, not long after the Chaldean oracles of Babylon began predicting his doom, he did indeed die, and the same doleful prophesying had probably helped to oust Darius before that. Prophecies could be self-fulfilling. Enemies would attack a man marked out for bad luck. A man apparently blessed would be left alone. Oracles, to put it simply, worked, and many of all types and importance vied with each other. At the greatest, such as at Delphi and Siwa, kings themselves might send for answers, receiving back those cryptic messages from the god via a human intermediary, usually a priest or priestess, absorbed in an ecstatic trance, or under the influence of psychotropic drugs. Romans would seek answers in the entrails of sacrificed animals, as interpreted by their augurs. Hero was interested in a somewhat more modest scale of fortune-telling, however, and one that could answer a large number of questions quickly and cheaply. So for all those worshippers who wished to know how a love affair might proceed, or whether a business transaction would be profitable, he invented an omen machine. The omen machine had to fulfill several requirements. It had to give apparently clear answers. It had to make money for the temple, and, most important of all, it had to give the people the answers they wanted. A temple equipped with one of these devices would not, of course, expose its mechanism. As a suppliant walked into the gloom of the temple's interior, he would see just a mechanical bird and a large wheel. After paying a suitable fee, he could ask the god a simple yes or no question and turn the wheel, and the bird would either sing or not. The god had spoken. Singing gave one answer, not singing another, and the priests could choose which was the more appropriate. Inside the mechanism, an air pump forced air through a pipe to make the birdsong effect when the wheel was turned. A simple cog attached to the inside of the mechanism could then be disengaged, perhaps by a priest, to silence the bird if the other answer was required. Hero's machines could also be found in the theatres Alexandrians attended for recreation. Theatre was a very big part of life in Alexandria and throughout the ancient Mediterranean world. It was not only where you got to see the latest plays, but also a place to be seen. It was the place where politics happened, where great speeches were made, where factions were formed and broken. It had even been the site of Julius Caesar's assassination. In the first century AD, all the world really was a stage. For the wealthy survivors from the old Ptolemaic regime and the new Roman administrators, putting on a big production was a good way to get noticed, and hence a good way to make a name for yourself. But standards were high, and the Alexandrian audience expected a lot. Just as in our modern city theatres, people wanted more than just brilliant dialogue and acting. They wanted spectacle, effects, something to transport them into the world of the play. Hero himself describes various forms of rotating backdrop for scene changes, flying galleries where gods and heroes could be winched into the air, and even thunder and lightning machines. But Hero wanted to take his audience a step further. To achieve this, he invented a piece of stage machinery with a unique ability to wheel itself on and off stage of its own accord at a preset time. Even older sources mention such self-propelling devices, although in an entirely mythical context, such as the god Hephaestus's magical tripods mentioned in Homer's Iliad.
Thetis of the Silver Feet made her way to the palace of Hephaestus, which the god of the crooked feet had built with his own hands of imperishable bronze. It shines like a star and stands out among the houses of the gods. She found Hephaestus hard at work and sweating as he bustled about at the bellow in his forge. He was making a set of 20 tripods to stand round the walls of his well-built hall. He had fitted golden wheels to all their legs so that they could run by themselves to a meeting of the gods and amaze the company by running home again. Homer, Iliad. Hero determined to make the myth a reality. The inside of Hero's automatic scenery was, in effect, a giant egg timer. As a huge hopper of sand emptied onto a platform, the weight pulled a cord wound around the axle, pushing the scenery forward. When the cord was fully unwound, the scenery stopped, hopefully on the right part of the stage. Sand now continued to pour from one container to the other, marking out a set period of time, and at its conclusion a lever switched and the scenery trundled back off stage again. Today, modern theatres use similar computer-controlled trucks to move scenery, but unlike modern versions, Heroes had a problem. Once the machine was put into action, there was no way to control it. If the actors spoke too slowly or fast, or if there was some interruption of the play, then the scenery might arrive or leave at the wrong time. A great speech might be rudely interrupted by the untimely departure of the street scene or leafy grove in which it was set. So Hero came up with a solution to this as well: automate the entire play, doing away with human actors altogether. Attempts at creating robotic theatres had also, perhaps surprisingly, been tried before, notably in the late 3rd century BC by Philo of Byzantium, who was himself an imitator of the Alexandrian Ctesibius. Although Philo's book on automatons is lost, Hero tells us that he proposed mechanical theatres powered by a simple weight on a rope. Unfortunately, this required that the theatre be perched on the edge of a cliff for the duration of the action. During these long drops, the weights tended to speed up too much, making the final scene more dramatic than intended as wooden actors, scenery, and theatre all suddenly hurtled over the cliff edge. Hero now proposed a much more complex system, and to demonstrate it he chose a play so complicated that it was almost impossible for human theatrical companies to put on. Nauplius is a classic Greek tale of tragedy and bloody revenge set just after the Trojan War, and centres on King Nauplius, whose son has been stoned to death by Ajax after being falsely accused of treason. Nauplius wants revenge and calls on the goddess Athena to help. Hero takes up the story. At the beginning the curtains open, then in the picture there appear 12 figures who are repairing the ship and moving it forward to be launched into the sea. These figures move themselves busily. One is sawing, the others are hammering, while yet others work with drills, and there is a great noise as of the sound of actual working. Hero of Alexandria, on automata. The curtains then close and open again on another ship being launched. The scene then changes again, and now there is a seascape with the one ship following the next. For some extra colour, Hero adds, "Often dolphins swim along with them, which quickly dive into the sea, then become visible just as they really do. Then the sea becomes stormy." When the curtains open again, the ships have gone, and we see old King Nauplius standing next to Athena, who is holding a burning torch. The curtains then close again and open one final time, where Hero tells us, "There appears the shipwreck of Ajax's boat, and Ajax swimming. A machine raises Athena above the stage out of view. Thunder crashes, and a bolt of lightning falls directly from above the stage onto Ajax, who is made to disappear. And in this way the story comes to its conclusion." Hero of Alexandria, on automata. To automate this entire play was a task of breathtaking ambition, but Hero went on to describe exactly how it could be done. The central power for all movements came, as before, from a hopper into which sand poured, the weight of sand pulling on a rope tied around a drum. As the rope was pulled down, the drum turned, providing the power. But rather than just having the drum slowly unwind in one direction, Hero programmed it by placing pegs on the drum's surface. Thus the rope could be wound around in one direction until it reached a peg, then looped around the peg to run in the other, making the drum reverse. With the pegs placed correctly,
The drum could be made to perform a complex series of turns and reverses, each one timed to provide the power for one of the scenes. So when his automatic theatre opened its curtains, its audience witnessed the closest thing to a modern movie anyone would see before the invention of the magic lantern in the 17th century. Nor were Hero's devices restricted to the temple and theatre. For the novelty-loving Roman with enough money to spare, Hero also devised mechanical toys for the home. Parties were just as important a part of ancient life as they are today, and then, just as now, it was customary to bring with you something to drink to help break the ice. In Hero's world, that something would probably be wine, and it presented a problem that has remained unchanged for centuries. As host, how do you make sure the guest doesn't bring cheap wine and then just drink your expensive stuff? Or from the guest's point of view, how do you make sure that other people don't drink all the good stuff you were kind enough to bring, leaving you with the dregs? For any party thrower, these were real questions, and Hero had a mechanical answer for them in his pneumatica. A vessel containing different wines, any one of which may be liberated by placing a certain weight in a cup. If several kinds of wine be poured into a vessel by its mouth, any one of them may be drawn out through the same pipe, so that if several persons have poured in the several wines, each one may receive his own according to the proportion poured in by him. Hero of Alexandria, Pneumatica. This was, in effect, a more elaborate version of the holy water dispenser. Inside the wine jar were three compartments into which each of three guests poured his or her wine. These were all connected to a single outlet, which was controlled by a valve. The valve had three open positions, one for each wine, and each weight would set it to one of these. When your guest poured his wine into the top, you handed him the weight that corresponded to the compartment he had filled. When he wanted a drink, he just placed his weight on the dispenser. That action set the valve to his position, and his own wine was then dispensed. But while Hero's inventions were mechanically ahead of their time, they represent something of a conundrum. Although his work undoubtedly was of practical use to temple priests, and he also describes civic projects, such as the construction of a fire engine, the vast majority of his work was simply of novelty value. For the Alexandrians of his day, Hero was not a mechanical genius, but just another in a long line of toy makers, a gadgeteer. It was this attitude that would lead people to overlook perhaps his greatest invention, one that would eventually change the world forever. Tucked away in his surviving notes lie his plans for an heliopile. He describes this novelty toy as two copper tubes soldered to the top of a sealed metal container. These passed through two metal sleeves, leading into each side of a copper sphere that could rotate between them. From the sphere emerged two outlets facing opposite each other. When water was boiled in the lower sealed compartment, steam would shoot out of the outlets, making the ball spin around, to the delight of the audience. And they should have been delighted and amazed. Spinning at around 1500 RPM, this was the fastest man-made rotating object in the ancient world. But it was much more than that. It was the first use of jet power. And more amazing still, it was, of course, a prototype steam engine. Had Hero combined this toy with a piston, something his fellow Alexandrian Ctesibius had invented some 300 years before, he could have created a working steam engine. But tellingly, he didn't. To Hero, all these technologies, so similar to those which take pride of place in our modern society, were simply curiosities. The descendants of the first items collected by the museum to help lecturers explain natural philosophy. Of course, even if Hero couldn't see the value of his toys, others could read about them. His extraordinary books continued to fill the shelves of the library. The Metrica, on measurement of surfaces. The Stereometrica, on measuring in 3D. The Mechanica, on how to move weights with the least effort. The Automata, on how to build robots. The Pneumatica, on devices worked by compressed air. The Dioptra, on taking measurements at a distance. The Catoptrica, on curved mirrors. Some of them made their way to Greece and Rome, but even there, no one realized the potential of these ingenious devices. There were fundamental problems with his heliopile design that certainly didn't help. The main problem with it was its efficiency, or lack thereof. To allow the ball to spin freely, the joints had to be made quite loose, but if the joints were loose, then a lot of the steam escaped through them.
Then there was the problem of fuel. In the Roman world, the boiler would have to be powered by wood, and that would have to be collected by someone, probably a slave. So if the useful energy gained from burning the wood to make the steam to turn the ball was less than the energy used by the slave to collect the wood, then the efficacy of the device would be lost, and the slave might as well be told to do the work himself. But it's not just efficiency that worked against Hero's steam engine. Those very slaves who would be needed to collect the fuel were themselves an obstacle to there ever being a Roman industrial revolution. The main use of steam engines during our industrial revolution was for producing cheap and readily available power. Hiring people to do jobs by hand was expensive, and it was sometimes difficult to get skilled people when you needed them. Steam engines could work day and night without rest. They were always available, and they were very strong. The Romans already had a source of cheap and plentiful labor in the form of slaves, and the Ptolemaic administration was particularly well suited to their use. If machines had replaced slaves, where would the slaves have gone? What would they do? No one wanted another Spartacus. For an elite whose wealth was based on land, such a device simply wasn't in their interests. And so Hero's greatest invention was condemned to be no more than a party novelty, just another description of a marvellous mechanical engine in a book in the vast Alexandrian library. The Romans had no real need for his work, so their interest in the contents of the world's greatest library lay not in the abstractions of Plato and Aristotle or in Hero's experimental physics. They were interested in the construction of siege engines and artillery, in the laying out of roads and cities, in harvesting the vast resources of their new conquests. The mechanical delights of wine dispensers and Antikythera mechanisms had their place, but a machine that undermined the whole base of their society, slavery, certainly did not. Therefore, the complexion of the library and museum was changing. What had been very much a royal society of selected scholars paid for by the Ptolemaic state was becoming a teaching institution where young nobles might finish their education. More and more it became obsessed with gathering, collating, and revising information rather than speculating and creating new ideas. So the Roman era ushered in a period of decline in the study of pure philosophy and literature. Alexandria would never see another Archimedes or Apollonius, but something new was flowing into the spiritual void left by the seeming prosaism of Roman world domination. What people on the streets of the city were now talking about was religion, emerging from the museum and combining in the streets with the more personal and powerfully held beliefs of those who now flocked here for education and enlightenment. A new age was dawning, in which old religions would undergo radical reinterpretations, and new cults would emerge which, in the crucible of Alexandria, would bring the ancient world to an end and set history on a new path.
Chapter 13. Urbi et Orbi. Behold now this vast city, a city of refuge, the mansion house of liberty, encompassed and surrounded with his protection. John Milton, Areopagitica. While Alexandria may have looked little different, perhaps even improved by Roman rule, the change in her fortunes had not left the minds of her inhabitants unaffected. As part of the Roman imperial project, Alexandrians were no longer their own masters, and what was decided in far-off Rome could have a direct effect on life in the city. A new era was dawning, an era of radical thought and new religions, many of which would take root in the city. In time the change would affect all parts of the population, but in the first years of the first century AD, no one would be affected more than the Jews. By the first century AD, the population of Alexandria had risen to about 1 million people, and many, perhaps a fifth of this number, were Jewish. Since the days of Persian and then Macedonian rule, this group had grown both in numbers and importance, until the quarter of the city they mainly gathered in, known as Delta, was the largest Jewish community in the world outside Palestine. A cornerstone of the growth of the city, they had become Hellenized, writing and speaking and, since the writing of the Septuagint, even reading their holy books in Greek. They were, however, a population apart, without the automatic right of citizenship enjoyed by their Greek neighbours, and so always vulnerable in times of crisis. In Hero's days, The single most powerful Jew in Alexandria was Alexander Lysimachus. His names, both Greek, a testament to Hellenization. He was in charge of collecting all customs dues on goods imported from the East, and became one of the richest men in the ancient world. So powerful had he become that he could marry one of his sons to the great-granddaughter of Herod the Great. The other son, Tiberius Julius Alexander, had risen to extreme prominence in Rome. Renouncing Judaism, he became the first procurator of the province of Judea, and later prefect of all Egypt. But Alexander Senior also had a brother, a man little interested in money, power, and worldly affairs. His name was Philo, and he would go down in history simply as Philo of Alexandria. Philo is important to our story because he spent his whole life writing in Alexandria. Not many of his extensive works deal specifically with town life, but because he drew on his own experiences, he cannot help but give us a glimpse of the people of the city. In doing so, he introduces us to an Alexandria missing from the records of geographers and philosophers, and looks beyond the marble walls and ornamental gardens into the minds of its inhabitants. Philo was born around 20 BC into one of the wealthiest and most privileged Jewish families in the city. As such, he was able to enjoy many of the liberties of citizenship, and at 14 years of age he would have been taken to the Serapeum, where a priest would have shorn his long childhood hair and enrolled him as an ephebos, a young man suitable to receive the most select education available. He would then have set out on the Encyclia, the secondary education program that included grammar, rhetoric, music, dialectics, geometry, and astronomy. As a physical counterpart to these mental exertions, he would have been required to walk across from the lecture halls to the great gymnasium, where he would learn boxing and wrestling, the main sports of the day. In the extensive grounds here, he would also have practiced the javelin and the discus, built his strength with the punching bag, and mixed with the other gilded youths who cooled their tired muscles in the fountains of the gymnasium's grounds. Outside his studies, he would also have become acquainted with some of the delights of his city, such as the theatre, reached, according to Polybius, by a covered gallery that wound from the water gardens, known as Meander, after the winding river in Asia Minor, past the wrestling arena. Here he would have seen the classical plays he quotes in his own books, and watched the politicians working the crowds. He and his friends would have bet on the outcome of the races in the Hippodrome before retiring to their own clubs for an evening of banqueting. This youthful regime was an entree into a life of great privilege, and Philo, a believer in the great chain of being that linked everyone and everything in order from the lowliest animals and humans up to God, knew he stood near the top, looking down over all but the mightiest leaders. His time as an ephebos probably also granted him full citizenship, marking him out from the ordinary Jews of the city. This gave him further rights, the right to marry as he chose and, most important, an exemption from the Roman poll tax. One of the most noticeable effects of Roman rule was an increase in taxation, particularly in Egypt, and a parallel increase in the brutality with which taxes were collected. Tax collectors were required to remit a certain figure to Rome, and Rome had no interest in how the collector went about gathering it or what he did with any surplus. This made the tax collector a powerful and terrifying figure, as we see from the horror that Jesus' decision to dine with one provokes in the New Testament. Tax collectors were not suited bureaucrats. They were thugs, sadists, and bullies. Philo records one case he witnessed in the marketplace in Alexandria. A man owing tax had fled to avoid paying, and in response the collector seized his closest family members, the elderly, women, and children. These he then set about publicly torturing. He filled a large basket with sand, and having hung this enormous weight by ropes round their necks, set them in the middle of the marketplace in the open air. They sank under the cruel stress of the accumulated punishments, the wind, the sun, the shame of being seen by passers-by, and the weights suspended on them. Philo of Alexandria, De Specialibus Legibus. The family would remain in the marketplace until the money was found, the tax evader returned, or they died. Either way, the Alexandrians would know better next time than to run from him. We do not know what happened to the family Philo saw. He tells us that many cast pitying glances at them, but, tellingly,
fails to mention anyone coming to their aid. Such horrors were just a normal part of life under Roman rule. Not being liable for the poll tax put Philo apart. He would never know the terror of the tax collector's call, never be humiliated in the marketplace. He was a man of position. But in the leisure hours that such privilege brought him, Philo was not wasting his time. At some point, as a young man, it seems, he turned back to his Jewish roots, and he began applying the skills he had learned in the Encyclia to analyzing his own religion. Above all, Philo was devoted to the Hebrew stories of his ancestors, in particular the revelatory teachings of the prophet Moses. He believed passionately that Moses was the original perceiver of divine wisdom, and that his doctrine formed the basis of Greek classical philosophy, actually referring to him as the summit of philosophy. When Philo compares Greek and Jewish scholarship, he cannot help but give precedence to Moses over all others, and even when he is quoting Plato, he has to add the caveat, "But Moses said the same thing as Plato, only earlier and better." This was not an entirely original position. Something similar had been attempted in the 1st century BC by an unknown author in a work known as The Wisdom of Solomon. But ever since the Septuagint had been translated, and Hebrew mythical thought came face to face with Greek philosophy, it had seemed inevitable that a figure would emerge who would try to develop a philosophical justification for Judaism in Greek terms. Philo was the man for the job, and set about it in great earnest. It would prove to be the happiest time of his life. "There was once a time when, by devoting myself to philosophy and to contemplation of the world and its parts, I achieved the enjoyment of that mind which was truly beautiful, desirable, and blessed. For I lived in constant communion with sacred utterances and teachings, in which I greedily and insatiably rejoiced." Philo, On the Unchangeableness of God. Philo's works are generally divided into three groups. In the first, he concentrates on a detailed analysis and paraphrasing of the biblical texts, with titles like On Joseph, The Life of Moses, On the Creation of the World, and On the Migration of Abraham. In much of this writing, Philo employs allegorical techniques to interpret the biblical stories, some of them very profound. For example, in his great Commentary on Genesis, he argues that the whole of Genesis is a metaphor for the history of the soul, from its formation at the dawn of the perceivable world to its fall, followed by its mature development as wisdom after its restoration through repentance. Interspersed among these biblical exegeses are more abstract pieces where Philo, the classically trained philosopher, comes to the fore, with titles like On the Virtues, On Drunkenness, On Flight and Finding, On the Unchangeableness of God, and On Dreams. In these works it is almost as if Philo is saturating himself with Jewish mythology, wanting to ingest and absorb every tiny nuance of the text. It has even been claimed that he sometimes spent hours contemplating a single word from the Bible, and all the time with one foot in the traditions of the great synagogue and the other in those of the museum, Philo was comparing and contrasting Moses with Plato, the Septuagint with the works of Socrates and Aristotle, the classical world with the Jewish. This process becomes much more transparent with the second series of his works, his philosophical treatises such as On the Liberty of the Wise, On the Incorruptibility of the World, On Providence, and On Animals, where he discusses man's relations to the natural world. Here he is deliberately abstracting the messages he has found in the Bible and codifying them in moral, ethical, and spiritual terms. That is, he is subjecting them to the same sort of rational treatment and thought processes which we find in the classical Greek philosophers. It is as though Philo has made a magnifying lens from Alexandrian philosophy and through it is now minutely inspecting the Jewish books of law. The result was a modernizing of Jewish law which, quite by accident, also laid out the philosophical foundations for a new religion, one Philo himself would undoubtedly have had little time for, and one which was still barely struggling into existence, Christianity. And he did this in an extraordinarily thorough and creative way. Philo, a firm believer in the great chain of being, began by placing God at the apex of his philosophical landscape. But his God is so totally infinite and all-pervasive that no individual creations can be attributed to him. Instead, Philo states that God is creativity itself. God is in a permanent state of creation. His executor is a separate entity. In the Wisdom of Solomon, the unknown author had called this entity Sophia, or Wisdom. Philo decided this entity was Logos, the Word of God. God is continuously ordering matter by his thought. His thinking was not anterior to his creating, and there never was a time when he did not create, the words themselves having been with him from the beginning. For God's will is not posterior to him, but is always with him, for natural motions never give out. Thus ever thinking, he creates and furnishes to sensible things the principle of their existence, so that both should exist together. The ever-creating divine mind and the sense-perceptible things to which beginning of being is given. Philo, De Presidentia. This whole idea is a modification, albeit a major one, of the Platonic doctrine, with God constantly generating the forms or ideas which then compose individual entities in the world, and actually brings the cosmic structure closer into line with a Jewish notion of angels and archangels as God's messengers, beings which Socrates calls demons, spelled D-A-E-M-O-N-S, a word later corrupted into demons, D-E-M-O-N-S, by the Christians. In another passage, Philo provides a splendidly Alexandrian analogy for this process when he compares it to planning a city in the mind of the builder. Now, we must form a somewhat similar opinion of God, who, having determined to found a mighty state, first of all conceived its form in his mind, according to which form he made a world perceptible only by the intellect, and then completed one visible to the external senses, using the first one as a model. Philo, De Opificio Mundi. It is hard to believe that, coming from such an erudite man who was brought up in and felt such passionate affection for Alexandria, there is not the smallest hint of Alexander and his lines of barley flour in this analogy. But from the theoretical perspective, what Philo did was introduce the Greek concept of the Logos, the Word, into Jewish religious thought, and thus provide the foundation of Christianity in which Christ himself could be seen as a manifestation of the divine Word. Philo had created the philosophical space in which the early church fathers would grow Christianity, apparently almost by accident. Yet there is a possibility that Philo had closer links with this developing sect than first appears. We should bear in mind that Philo was alive at the same time as Christ, and that the New Testament documents were written in Greek by Jewish intellectuals who are part of the Hellenistic culture of the Greco-Roman world, even though they had, of course, converted to Christianity. Unlike Judaism, Christianity is a proselytizing religion, and the desire of the apostles to at least approach one of the most important figures in Hellenized Judaism seems highly plausible. Scholars have in fact argued that there are echoes of Philo, echoes of Alexandria, to be found in the writings of St. Paul, in the Gospels, especially the Book of John, and in the Epistle to the Hebrews. There are also hints of early Christian practice in another of Philo's fascinations with a contemplative communal life. Philo, though believing that a family life was best for most people, was intrigued by religious groups that lived communally. He wrote about the Jewish Essenes of Palestine, now known to have been the guardians of the Dead Sea Scrolls. But it was a community closer to home that most interested him. One of Philo's most popular works was a book called Contemplative Life. In it he describes a community of hermits, the Therapeuti, who lived on a low hill just outside Alexandria, on the banks of Lake Mareotis. This group held everything in common and spent their lives in rigorous religious study. Each member had a cabin, in which was a room set aside for the study of sacred texts. Here they would study from dawn to dusk, 6 days a week, without food or drink, until they reached a state of religious ecstasy. On the seventh day, they would gather together for holy service in their great hall before returning to their books. The community Philo describes is clearly a Jewish one, but he hints that other such communities also existed, and these would seem to provide the model for the early Christian monastic groups,
particularly the Nitrian monks of the Egyptian desert, who would one day play such an important role in the life of Alexandria itself. It was the view of the Greek Christian historian Eusebius that the Therapeuti were in fact a community of early Christians, and he speculated that Philo himself may have been a Christian. This was certainly not the case, but what Philo did in his rigorous synthesis of Greek and Jewish philosophy was to delineate the landscape in which Christianity could develop. As such, Eusebius's claim that so great a philosopher must be a Christian is perhaps understandable, and we should at least be grateful to Eusebius for helping to preserve Philo's philosophy, whatever his reasons. By contrast, the Jewish and Greek establishments seem to have been less impressed with Philo's work, either ignoring or dismissing it. He describes their depressing reaction when he explained his revelations to them, the sophists of literalness, as sneering and staring at him superciliously. Philo was not to spend his whole life in simple contemplation, however. As one of the most influential Jews in the city, he had, whether he liked it or not, to take a part in civic affairs. For all its intellectual tolerance, Alexandria was still extremely volatile politically, even under the Romans. The populace was acutely divided by class, race, and creed, and anarchy was never more than a stone's throw away for the Alexandrian mob. It must have been a harsh come-down for Philo, from the ecstasies of contemplation to the real, dirty, racist, violent, and fearful world of street life. This would be the dangerous stage on which the battle for the hearts and minds of Alexandrians would be fought, and it was here that Philo would feel the grip of Roman rule. The early days of Roman rule had promised much to the Jews. Augustus had favoured them, as had his successor, Tiberius. But on Tiberius's death, the appalling potential of imperial power became all too evident with the accession of the Emperor Gaius, known today by his childhood nickname Caligula, or Little Boots. If we take the Roman historian Suetonius at his word, Caligula's rule was marked by arbitrary executions, forced suicides, and increasing megalomania. If his prefects and governors wished to keep their jobs and their lives, they had to go to any length to please him. In Alexandria, the man with that unenviable job was Avilius Flaccus, prefect of Egypt. In an attempt to ingratiate himself with the emperor, he turned to three notorious marketplace rabble-rousers, Lampo, Dionysius, and Isidorus, who suggested that persecution of the Jews who had refused to worship Caligula as a god would increase his popularity with the city mob, and hence secure his position. As the flames of anti-Semitic feeling were fanned, the Jewish community asked Herod Agrippa, a Jewish king in Palestine and a family friend of Philo's, to intercede on their behalf. It was his arrival in the city that sparked the first outrages. Gathering in the gymnasium, the mob began ridiculing the king. They had found a man in the marketplace, whom Philo describes. There was a certain lunatic named Carabas, whose madness was not of the fierce and savage kind, but of the easier-going, gentler style. He spent day and night in the streets, naked, shunning neither heat nor cold, made game of by the children and the lads who were idling about. Philo of Alexandria, the embassy to Gaius. This poor creature, dressed by the mob as Herod, was paraded through the streets. When the mob reached the theatre, it demanded that a statue of Caligula be placed in the synagogue, claiming that the Jews had failed to honour the divine emperor as they should. Not having a statue of Caligula at hand, they dragged an old, corroded statue of a charioteer from the gymnasium. The prefect did nothing to stop this desecration. Indeed, he issued a statement denouncing Alexandria's ancient Jewish population as foreigners with no legal rights. An orgy of looting ensued, while the Jews were rounded up and forced into a small part of the Delta district. Philo explains their plan. After driving these many myriads of men, women, and children, like herds of cattle, out of the whole city, into a very small portion, as into a pen, they expected in a few days to find heaps of dead massed together. Those Jews who were caught searching for food outside this ghetto were beaten and stoned. Even Philo's own privileged class did not escape. Members of the Jewish governing body were rounded up and scourged like common criminals in the theatre, and some were even crucified. Eventually the situation calmed,
and Flaccus found to his dismay that the pogrom had not had the desired effect. The extremely irrational, or perhaps calculating, Caligula had decided for the moment that this was not what he wanted. And when two of the governor's henchmen, Lampo and Isidorus, saw this change of heart, they were quick to condemn Flaccus to their paranoid emperor. Orders were soon sent for his arrest, and after exiling him on a barren Aegean island, Caligula eventually tired of him altogether, and soldiers were sent to murder him. Alexandria had shown itself to be a tinderbox. At one level, the most cosmopolitan city on earth, it was always teetering on the brink of a dramatic descent into racial violence. Even with Flaccus gone, the peace in the city remained fragile. Caligula had once more turned against the Jews, threatening to destroy the temple in Jerusalem if they persisted in refusing to worship him. If he did, all Jews in the empire would overnight become fair game for their persecutors. Alexandria was on tenterhooks, and in the following year both Jewish and anti-Jewish delegations headed for Rome to plead their case directly before the emperor. The Jewish group was headed by Philo himself. After months of prevarications, the highly unstable Caligula agreed to meet Philo, but ominously began the interview with, "Are you the God-haters who do not believe me to be a God, a God acknowledged among all other nations, but not to be named by you?" Fortunately for the Jews of Alexandria, Caligula seemed indifferent to the situation in the city, and offered the anti-Jewish faction no more than he had offered Philo. In AD 41, on January the 24th, Caligula's assassination finally brought the sorry episode to an end. His successor, Claudius, ordered that the Greeks of the city show toleration to the Jews and that the violence stop forthwith. He did not want to be considered a god in his lifetime, and he did not want his statue erected in the synagogue. Peace had been restored. But Roman Alexandria had shown another ugly face which would change the whole complexion of the city. Philo died peacefully in AD 50 or 55. He had witnessed a haunting warning of what was to come in the city, but he had also experienced the heights of philosophical ecstasy still accessible in the gardens and porticos of the museum. And it was in those still quiet groves that another great Alexandrian would soon rise to prominence, a man who would show that if the city's body was beginning to look diseased, its mind was still as healthy as ever. Claudius Ptolemy looked beyond the confines of his turbulent city to the world outside, the whole world, and the heavens beyond that. His works would become the cornerstone of science until the Renaissance, and their influence is still seen today. As with his illustrious antecedent Euclid, we know almost nothing of the life of Claudius Ptolemy. His name suggests that he was a Roman citizen of Greek extraction, as citizens usually took Roman first names. Though some have argued that he was born in the Egyptian town of Ptolemais, hence his surname, there is no solid evidence to support this claim. Nor is there any evidence that he was connected to the royal Ptolemies, though this mistake was made repeatedly in subsequent centuries, and he is often portrayed with a crown and scepter. It is pretty certain from the calibre of his work and the detail of the material he makes reference to that he was educated and spent his working life in Alexandria, where a few years before his birth the Roman Emperor Claudius, having brought peace to the streets, considerably expanded the museum. It is possible that while there he was either tutored by or received patronage from a man by the name of Cyrus, to whom all his major works are dedicated. But this man has yet to be identified. In the true Alexandrian tradition, Claudius Ptolemy was an extraordinary polymath, writing about mathematics, music, astronomy, astrology, optics, philosophy, geography, and cartography. But also in his work is a hint as to how the museum was changing. His books, magnificent as they are mainly syntheses. Where Ptolemy does venture into unexplored realms, he is often wrong in his interpretation. Indeed, there is even the suggestion that he made up data to match his hypotheses. However, there is no questioning the lucidity of his style and the clarity of presentation, and it is these which would carry his work and his name down the centuries. At the beginning of his mammoth work on astronomy, he tells us, "We shall try to note down everything which we think we have discovered up to the present time. We shall do this as concisely as possible, and in a manner which can be followed by those who have already made some progress in the field. For the sake of completeness in our treatment, we shall set out everything useful for the theory of the heavens in proper order, but to avoid undue length we shall merely recount what has been adequately established by the ancients. However, those topics which have not been dealt with by our predecessors at all, or not as usefully as they might have been, will be discussed at length to the best of our ability.
Claudius Ptolemy, Almagest. Ptolemy was nothing if not comprehensive. In this massive work he suggests a complex mathematical model for the workings of the universe, and he produces a star catalogue listing 1,022 stars in 43 constellations, which is, incidentally, 22 more stars than Tycho Brahe could manage at the end of the 16th century. Ptolemy clearly considered his book to be a practical manual, not merely a reference work, and he wanted it used by and distributed to as wide a portion of the population as possible, and in doing this he became one of the world's first popular publishers. Having finished the main work, he collected together the tables of practical use to astronomers which are scattered throughout it, and published them in a slim volume known as the Handy Tables. He then decided to write a popular account for lay readers, a sort of paperback version called Planetary Hypothesis.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.